This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 186 was recorded on September 26th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the only podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, which I highly recommend. Harley Bassman, the convexity maven, joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the fixed income market in detail, and then we'll review some more advanced trades that Harley just published on his website this week. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick will have yet another of his famous chart books for extended equity market analysis.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 has, at least after the option expiration, the quad witching, started to kind of roll over a little bit, but I wouldn't call this any heavy selling whatsoever. What's your thinking on what the S&P 500 is doing here?
Well, Patrick, considering everything that's wrong in the world, which is a long list, the president perhaps being impeached, although frankly, I think that's political theater, but a lot of people are taking it seriously, the repo crisis continuing to escalate, there's lots of reasons to be concerned here. Yet still, we're just a stone's throw away from all-time highs. As you will hear on Macro Voices All-Stars on Friday, Juliet DeClercq will make the prediction that the Fed will announce QE4, another round of quantitative easing, in the fourth quarter of this year. Now, if Juliet's right about that, of course, she could be wrong. But if she's right, what have we seen historically? Always, when the Fed announces more QE, the stock market rips higher. And I think that just as Juliet is anticipating that possibility, then I think a lot of other people are. And that's probably the reason that we're up here. And I think we're getting ready maybe for a breakout to new all-time highs. But it's a real quandary here, Patrick. This repo crisis is real for the reasons that Jeff Snyder has described in his many appearances on All Stars. There's something really broken with dollar liquidity. Now, if the Fed is going to fix it by flooding the market with QE4, well, that fixes the problem, and it also gives lots of people lots of reason to buy stocks, and we rip higher. If this repo crisis, whatever's going on, something really breaks before the Fed does that, then you could see a crash. So I'm happy to be on the sidelines. I don't want to be long here because I don't believe in the fundamentals for this market, but I don't dare to be short because I think Juliet could be right. We could have another round of QE coming. You know, it's amazing, Patrick. We've gone from when Powell took office, the message was, hey guys, I'm not in the business of bailing out the stock market. Now it seems like we've come full circle around to the point where it's like, yeah, we're in the business of preemptively bailing out the stock market before it even gets into trouble. So if that's the way that this is going to go, if monetary policy is going to take us to another round of QE, you know we're going to rip higher. So I'm happy to be on the sidelines. I don't dare to be short and I don't want to be long.
Well, let's move on to the dollar index, because even though the stock market seems muddled right now, the dollar, on the other hand, seems to have quite a bit of tailwind. Is this a rally for real in your mind?
Well, you know, this time we're surging above 98.50, the round number there. Last week, the battle was for 98 even. And of course, these numbers are on the new December futures contract, which has some backwardation in it. So, you know, 98.50 is the old 99. And, you know, this is definitely looks like the market's continuing, but it's not the really strong breakout that I was expecting. And I think that the repo madness that we're seeing implies that that breakout is coming. But again, if Juliet were right and we really do have another round of QE coming, that changes the picture. I think what's going on here is a lot of dollar bears are selling what they perceive to be a top here. And it's the point at which those bears capitulate and say, okay, something more is going on than we thought. That's where you suddenly get a really big jerk higher. I thought it was going to happen by now. It hasn't yet. So we'll have to keep an eye on it and see what comes next.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because it seems to be giving back almost everything from that Saudi Arabian attack pop that it had earlier. But what's your take on oil, and how did the inventory numbers come in?
Well, let's start with the EIA inventory numbers. Crude oil surprise build again this week, 2.4 million barrel build. Cushing, Oklahoma, also building 2.3 million barrels. That kind of brings to an end a long streak of drawdowns in Cushing, Oklahoma. But wait a minute, don't get too excited about that, because remember that big storm in Texas last week resulted in the shut-in of a couple of pipelines. So there's a lot of oil that's being landlocked in Cushing due to those pipeline outages, and it's going to be very interesting to see if we go back to a pattern of more drawdowns in coming weeks. Meanwhile, gasoline building 519,000 barrels, so we got builds across the board with the singular exception of distillates, but it's a big exception, 3 million barrel drawdown on distillates. The tape action, really, you saw all of the selling happen on Wednesday before the number came out. A lot of people were anticipating that it was going to be a build. And by the time the number came out, it was kind of a buy-the-news event, if you will, instead of a sell-the-news event. We bounced off, but then today, we went down and took out a new low going below that 55 spot 61, which was the gap. So we've closed the gap from the Abgeg attacks in Saudi Arabia. And it looked like this afternoon we were going to really take it out and keep going to the downside. But just before the close, we got a sudden relief rally and went all the way up and tested the 100-day moving average before the close. I won't be the slightest bit surprised, Patrick, if we have a significant update tomorrow on Friday. And the reason is simply, think about the way these things usually go down. You've got two options here for the U.S. to respond to this. One is with sanctions. One is with military action against Iran. Well, how do they usually carry out sanctions? With as much hype and hoopla and press and PR as they possibly can to make a big stink over it. How do they carry out military operations? Hush, hush, nobody says a word until after the strike happens because they want to keep it secret. Well, I haven't heard very much about Iranian sanctions this week, and it makes me wonder, since a lot of these military actions happen on a weekend, whether maybe there's something coming. Now, that's just a wild guess. I don't have any special information, but I think a lot of other people are saying, I think if I'm going to pick a weekend to be short crude oil on Friday, this is probably not that weekend. So I think that most likely we'll see more upside tomorrow, Friday, but I won't be surprised if there is no military reaction to Iran. If it becomes clear that that's not going to happen, I think we'll probably sell back off again next week.
Eric, it just looked like the other day that gold was once again breaking out, going to look like it was heading right back to its highs. And then just the other day, it gives almost all of the breakout back. We're trading around 15, 14 right now. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, Patrick, dollar strength is finally proving to be at least a small headwind. Maybe it's just a head breeze, I'm not sure, for gold. It was coincident with the dollar moving sharply higher that gold finally sold off. But, you know, like a lot of people, I've been expecting a real pullback, a significant pullback, like $100 kind of pullback. We haven't seen anything close to that yet. Now, I still think that a bigger pullback is coming. Nothing goes in a straight line in this market. I mean, gold is just up so much so quickly, it's overdue for some kind of pullback. No matter how bullish you are, it's technically time for a pullback. But in order for that gold correction to really happen in a significant way, we need the geopolitics to settle down first. So we don't have the president of the United States supposedly being impeached, if you believe that that's really happening, or the biggest and most critical oil processing facility in the world being attacked by drones. We need a couple of weekends of peace and quiet around the world before that risk premium can come out. So I do think that we're still overdue for a pullback, but my confidence that we might get down significantly below 1400 is starting to diminish here, as gold has really impressed me with how resilient it's been, despite how quickly we've gone so far so fast.
All right, Eric, I want to move on to that 10-year treasury yield, because we started September with almost a 50 basis point rise from in just literally the first half of September, and then we gave half of it back. We're trading around that one spot 70 level. Where are yields going next in your mind?
I think they're still going lower. You know, I bought it at one spot 78, and I was a little bit early. I think we got almost up to 2% before it turned around. Looks to me like the rally is on. Now, of course, if Julia DeClercq were right and we really have a new round of QE coming, that could change things substantially. That's just Juliet's prediction. We'll have to see what happens. And I also think it's going to be really important to see how this dollar liquidity crisis with the repo market resolves itself. And I think that will probably play into it. So lots of question marks, but barring surprises, I think we continue to move lower in yield.
All right. Now, Eric, before we move on to that feature interview with Harley, you announced this week that you are suspending the Energy Week podcast until further notice. What's the story there?
Well, when we launched the expanded content back in May, I explained that I can't subsidize Macro Voices out of my own pocket any longer, and we needed to take on sponsors to recover our production costs through advertising. Initially, we got a huge number of donations because people loved the new content, and we were delighted to secure Top Traders Unplugged as a sponsor for this podcast. But the flow of donations, frankly, has tapered off considerably. And while we're still talking to several prospective sponsors for Macro Voices and for All Stars, we really haven't had any serious sponsor inquiries pertaining to Energy Week. Meanwhile, Energy Week is the most expensive show that we produce in terms of production costs because we have to edit a four-way conversation. It's much more work for our production staff. I hope, Patrick, that a sponsor will step up at some point and be ready to sponsor Energy Week. But until one does, we're going to have to suspend the Energy Week podcast. In order to keep listeners up to date on the oil market, we'll go back to our former practice of occasionally doing a crude oil special here on the Thursday flagship podcast. But I can't keep subsidizing all of this new content out of my own pocket. And so far, we don't have any sponsor for Energy Week, so we're going to have to put it to bed for a while.
All right. Well, quite a few of our listeners have written to us saying that they love the new content and would be happy to pay a subscription fee for it. Why haven't we taken them up on that offer?
Well, Patrick, if producing Macro Voices was my primary occupation, that would make plenty of sense. But it's not. It's certainly possible to produce a paid subscription podcast. There are other people that do it. There's software that provides that capability. But it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of legwork to set it up so that you have to get private RSS feeds for everyone that's a subscriber to download the subscription-only content and so forth. And there are platforms for that, but it takes a lot of time and energy that, frankly, if I'm going to spend time and energy on Macro Voices, I'd rather spend that time and energy producing more interviews. The other problem is that a subscription podcast has a tiny audience size compared to a free podcast, and that means that it's less appealing for our guests because their message reaches a much smaller audience, and in turn, that makes it harder to recruit the very best guests. So for all these reasons, I'm convinced that a combination of voluntary donations and paid advertising are the best way to monetize the content to recover our production costs. But until more sponsors step up to the plate and or donations pick up again, I'm afraid we're going to have to start scaling back on the additional content.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest features economist Harley Bassman. Now, why did we invite Harley back as this week's featured guest?
I really love Harley, Patrick. He's one of my favorite people that we interview. And I think he's almost unique in the sense that he's not selling anything. Almost everybody else that we have on the program, you know, they've got some product or service. And the reason that they are willing to give us their time is because they've got something to promote. And we give them a chance at the end to plug whatever they're selling. Harley's just a very, very successful, somewhat famous finance guy, the inventor of the MOVE Index, which is essentially the VIX for the bond market. He's retired. He's a private investor now. He's got a lot of passion and a lot of energy, spends a lot of time on his own blog website, which is called ConvexityMaven.com. And, you know, he's not pushing anything. He just loves talking finance. So he's one of my favorite people to talk to. We haven't had him on in quite a while. And with all the shenanigans going on in the repo market, I thought it was a good time to get a fixed income expert in just to talk about what's going on and what some of the other liquidity drivers could be in the market. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by toptradersunplugged.com. You often hear me say that even if I have conviction about a market or a trade, you have to listen to what the market is telling you, not what you think it should be doing. And that's exactly what trend-following managers have been doing for decades with great success. These are rules-based strategies that remove human emotions and therefore can be well-researched and back-tested. And there's one podcast that covers trend-following strategies better than any other, toptradersunplugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book called The Many Flavors of Trend Following, explaining exactly how these systematic strategies can work for you. Just go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's toptradersunplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Harley Bassman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Harley Bassman, operator of Convexity Maven, a macroeconomic website. And of course, Harley is very widely credited as the inventor of the MOVE Index, which is essentially the volatility index, or VIX, for the bond market. Harley, I want to start with that point, actually, not just to credit you as the inventor, but I interviewed Danielle DiMartino Booth earlier this week, and her comment was, you know, so many people are sort of like, oh my gosh, is the economy about to fall over into recession? Let's keep an eye on the stock market and watch for signals. Her comment was, forget the stock market, watch the MOVE Index. She thinks that what's about to happen, if something's about to happen, it's going to happen in the bond market. Now, since you're the guy who invented the MOVE Index, how useful is it as far as a leading indicator or a predictive signal that might tell us that something is wrong?
I think that she's spot on right. The bond market's going to be where all the action is, and that will be where to keep your eyes focused because of, you know, central bank intervention is the key driver right now. But looking at the MOVE per se as an indicator, it's more of a coincident indicator than forward-looking. So it'll basically confirm movements in the bond market because there's a whole group of hedge funds out there that operate as, you know, vol sellers to go reap profits. And so they can kind of keep the MOVE kind of in line with realized volatility. So as realized volatility, realized activity, realized risk expands, the MOVE will go with it.
Okay, so we can use the MOVE Index, I think the way Danielle was describing it, as a confirmation indicator. If it feels like shit's hitting the fan and the MOVE is going crazy, it's a good indication that it really is hitting the fan, but probably not a predictor. Is that a good summary?
Oh, yeah. It sounds great.
So let's back this conversation up to the much bigger picture of the bond market. For a while, we had everybody and their brother, except you, saying, okay, look, as soon as we get past 3.12 or whatever the magic technical number was on the 10-year yield, that's it, baby. It's all over. The bond bull market, it's history. It's going to be the end is nigh for the bond market. You were quite outspoken last time we had you in the show, and you said, look, this is mostly about demographics. We're not going past, I think you said 350 on the 10-year. It's just not going to happen. Needless to say, you got that one right. But what I don't remember from that interview, I don't think that you had anticipated this reversal in yields all the way back down to almost that 2016 low. Is this consistent with what you expected, and what do you see coming next?
I would love to go say that I was brilliant at predicting the market to rally this much, but no, that wasn't in my playbook. But when rates were 3 and changed, I think they'd go higher. No. I haven't changed my mind in a few years now. We're not going to go above 3.5% till 2023 at the earliest. And it's purely a demographic concept. The boomers are retiring. And as they retire, they are selling stocks and buying bonds. You can see this on almost any large firm's flow of funds. Retail people have been sellers of stocks for a decade now. The only buyers of stocks have been corporate buybacks. And they're moving their money into bonds because they need fixed income. They need retirement income. And they know Social Security can cover it for them. So you have this massive flow of money out of stocks into bonds from real boomers. And the other side of the coin is the millennials forming households. They get married, they have their first child much later than the prior generation. And so it's taking a little time for these people to enter the workforce, become productive, and demand goods and services, cars, baby strollers, houses, whatever it might be. That mismatch is going to basically flip over in 2023, more or less, 23, 25, and that's going to go and drive rates higher, the same way in the 70s and 80s, the boomers drove rates higher.
Now, let's touch on the stock market since you mentioned it. I agree with you that boomers are selling stocks and buying bonds. Now, before this happened, a lot of people predicted this is going to happen. Boomers are going to sell stocks and buy bonds. Therefore, the stock market's going straight down. Well, oddly, we've seen the confirmation. In fact, boomers are selling stocks and buying bonds. But those corporate buybacks have been a big part of it. And it seems like there's also a lot of international flows. Even though global stock markets are definitely rolling over around the world, the S&P is right at the on the verge of all-time highs as we're speaking. What the heck is going on? Is it? I mean, you mentioned corporate buybacks, but that's not enough by itself, is it, to keep us at these crazy elevated levels?
I think so. The numbers have been huge for corporate buybacks, and with rates down here, it's all the more reasonable. I mean, if you're a corporation and you're trying to, you know, work on your balance sheet, you know, there's a trade-off between debt and equity. This is, you know, MBA 101. And with rates down here, issuing debt and buying back stock is not nutty. As a matter of fact, I mean, you could borrow money at less than the dividends are being paid by the S&P. Now, it does have a negative corollary is you're levering the company up and you're making it less able to ride out a storm, which we saw in, 07, 08, 09. Investment banks, you know, levered, 20, 28 to 1. And when things got rough, down they went. So it's not, all fun and games. But realistically, buying back stock at these prices is not nutty relative to bonds. I know that CAPE says that stocks are crazy hot. There's lots of other analysts out there that think stocks are rich. And, you know, Shiller says that there's no correlation of rates to the CAPE. I just disagree. That just sounds crazy to me. If you have money in your pocket, you want to invest it, you're going to make a decision based upon all your available opportunities, which is stocks, bonds, commodities, art, housing, whatever it might be. And if rates are, 1%, 1.5%, stocks that yield 2 and have a PE of 18, 19, that's not bad. Stocks are not cheap. Let's be clear. Stocks aren't cheap, but they're not crazy rich. I call them on the higher side of fair.
Okay, Harley. So if the argument is that basically what's going on here is retail really is not buying stocks, it's not the usual retail craziness that is pushing the stocks to higher and higher prices, but it's all about corporate buybacks. And clearly, we've got low rates, and a lot of people think lower rates still to come. There aren't too many headwinds that are going to get in the way of this. Are there other factors? I mean, obviously, the corporations can't buy back all of their stock with money that they get from selling bonds. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any stock market at the end. Is there a point at which you reach an absorption level where this corporate buyback trend stops providing a bid to the market overall? Or is this something that could go on for years and years to come?
I don't think it goes on forever. And there is a limit, clearly, to how much stock you can buy back and be a prudent manager of your corporation. But I think you were right before the point you mentioned about international buyers. To quote an old boss of mine, we are the cleanest dirty shirt. We have growth. We have a solid economy. Dividends nice. It's not that bad. And if we have lower rates, QE going on in Europe, in Japan, moving money to the U.S. is also not crazy. It's quite reasonable. So I think, as much as the Fed might want to go and not be lowering rates, QE in Europe and Japan is positive. It's fungible money going into the system, seeking out assets, diversified assets that are kind of safe. So I think there's money coming there. Now the question is Europe and Japan cutting rates and doing QE, is that good for the global economy? As a public policy concept, is this good, or are they just basically jumping ahead of us in a currency war? That's a different question.
Harley, let's continue on the bond market direction. Here we are now seeing at least a temporary backing up of rates. We got below 1.50 on the 10-year. Is there a potential that this is a trend reversal, or was this just a little hiccup and we're still headed lower in yield?
I mean, rates are still dramatically lower than they were 6 months ago. Could rates back up 50 from here? Sure, why not? We're in a big range. And could we go lower in rate? I suppose so. But I think that, at these interest rate levels, bonds become somewhat unappealing just because it's basically a zero real yield at this point. To the extent you want to buy longer-dated bonds over here, you're buying them because you have an actuarial problem. Your insurance company or pension, and you kind of have to buy it by regulation. But going out the curve at these prices, I'm not a buyer. I'd rather invest in 2 years and have powder to burn.
Harley, a big debate that's been going on in finance between a lot of people is the U.S. going to follow Europe into negative rates? What's your take on it? And if it were to happen, what's the significance? What would it mean? What would the consequences and knock-on effects be?
Well, my stated opinion for quite a while is we will not have negative rates in the U.S. I haven't changed my mind on that. I think we have a different society, different politic than Europe and Japan. And I also think that if we were to get negative rates, that the politicians would be assaulted by the populace. I just don't see it happening. Aside from the fact, I don't think it would be effective at all. But, you know, negative rates in the financial capital of the world, you're talking about, you know, kind of pulling up the foundation of the banking system, which was kind of the idea of QE1 to begin with, was to go and solidify that. So I don't think it happens here. I think they'll find other measures. And as I've written about recently, it's going to be fiscal policy. That's where we go next.
And speaking of fiscal policy, you know, normally we think of the political cycle affecting fiscal but not monetary policy. First of all, we've got an election coming up. Obviously, President Trump has been a contentious president, regardless of whether you're a supporter or not. You can't deny that he's been a very outspoken leader and has a style which delights some people and infuriates others. What do you think is going to be on the political agenda in this election year in terms of fiscal policy? But also, my view is I think monetary policy is going to become a big campaign issue, and particularly modern monetary theory, MMT. Although MMT itself is not necessarily suggesting that we ought to borrow and spend out of control, I think a lot of politicians who want an excuse to borrow and spend out of control are citing MMT as sort of their academic evidence to make it okay to want to do that. How do you think that the political cycle and election year is going to factor into both fiscal and monetary policy?
Well, notwithstanding the name, MMT is not a monetary policy, it's a fiscal policy. And monetary policy is basically rate setting and, you know, money supply, buying and selling bonds into the market. That's done. We've kind of cooked that goose. There's nothing else to do there. I mean, the Fed might do it, but it's not going to be effective. We've seen that thing play out. So fiscal policy is next. MMT will be the sheep's clothing for fiscal spending. And whether we do it quietly via infrastructure spending or we do UBI to go and give people money, helicopter money, that's what's going to happen next. And both sides of the aisle will be in favor of this because it solves everyone's problem. And the problem, as I spoke about at the beginning, is how do you deal with the baby boom demographic who's retiring, did not save enough money, and Social Security is not a big enough number to support their lifestyle. So we're going to have to go and solve that problem somehow, some way. And if you've seen a number of charts and graphs from various people, the expansion, the amount of the government that's absorbed by mandatory spending grows enormously in the next 10 years. That is the public policy problem, A, number one. It has to be resolved and dealt with. And I think MMT will be the way you start going after it. Do I believe it? Do I like it? No, not at all. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. So that's my view. If the Democrats win, it'll happen, you know, in 2021. If Republicans win, it'll happen in 2029. That's the window of when the boomers kind of all jump into retirement. Next year, we'll hit midway in retirement, and 2029, all the boomers will be 65 and over.
Harley, earlier you agreed with Danielle DiMartino that if there's going to be a crisis, the bond market is more likely than the stock market to be the place where it's going to start. What kind of bond market crisis are you envisioning as a possibility?
I don't see it happening soon, but what I do see is that come, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, as the boomers retire and the millennials come into fore, there'll be demand side on the economy, and that will be what pushes up rates and what creates real inflation. And then how do you kind of deal with that becomes more interesting. I don't foresee a giant crisis coming up unless, you know, there's some sort of political, you know, foolishness going into the election. Is that possible? Yeah, likely. Unclear. You know, the Fed is doing a reasonably good job of trying to go and stay down the middle. Despite being an arm of the government, they're trying to remain independent and not be drawn into this the battle. And so I'm not terribly concerned. Maybe I should be, but I'm not. I just think that there's still such demand out there for debt instruments from pensions and insurance and everyone else that it will kind of keep a lid on things until we get real inflation and all of a sudden you have significant negative rates, negative real rates.
Well, I agree with you. It's when we get a runaway inflation that is when things really come unglued, and it seems to me that we're nowhere close to that yet. If there's anyone I have confidence in to get us there, it's the MMTers, though. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I would add one more thing in here, though. Away from monetary policy and fiscal policy, trade policy is interesting, and I'm sure there's experts out there who could opine upon how impactful it is right now. But what I think is more important is actually immigration policy. What drives, you know, these rates, as I've been talking in demographics, ultimately, it's the labor force growth rate, how fast the labor pool expands. Because end of the day, GDP is number of people times hours worked times productivity. The U.S. has been very open to immigration, and therefore we've had a nice labor force growth rate going on post-World War II. You have not seen that in Japan and Europe. Japan actually is the ultimate poster child of what happens when you have a negative birth rate. To the extent that immigration policy chokes off another source of labor, that will be a big problem. It doesn't hit the market right away, but to the extent we choke off the supply of immigrant labor and don't have an offsetting massive growth of the birth rate, which, by the way, takes about 20 years to cook, I think that's going to be a real problem. And that's my biggest concern about the economy away from demographics.
Harley, a lot of notable people who were never gold bugs before, particularly Ray Dalio, have recently said, hey, if you look at what's coming, the interest rates are going to continue to go low. The Fed is going to have to continue to effectively monetize. There's going to be more QE. You know it's coming. And the fundamentals for gold have never looked better. Do you agree with that view? And what do you make of the recent breakout? Are we overextended here, or is it actually time to buy?
I will not call myself a gold bug, but I like gold. Warren Buffett is incorrect. Gold is not some, you know, dead asset that doesn't have a yield. Gold is an alternate currency, the same way euros or yen are. It's accepted, it's fungible. I wrote a great piece about this a few years ago called Rumpelstiltskin at the Fed, one of my favorites. And if you think of it as a currency, like dollar bills, because there's no interest earned on holding a dollar bill in your hand, right? Gold as a currency. If you believe that we're going to have MMT and QE and money printing of fiat currency, then gold is a very interesting way to have a different currency that can't be printed. I think every diversified portfolio should have some allocation to gold, and it's a longer term trade. It's almost an insurance policy. And as I wrote about, gold has a negative yield also. Right now, it yields about negative 3.5%, which is nothing wrong with that when you consider the cost of insuring it and everything else. So I like gold. And it's not a market-level trade. I like it here. I liked it when it was 1,100. I liked it when it was 1,700. It's an alternate currency that you own as diversification in case things really go haywire.
I want to move on now to an article that you just published on your website called The Opposite of Bad is Worse. Listeners, you'll find the download link for that article in your Research Roundup email. Why don't we start with the title? It's a catchy title. What do you mean? Which bad are we talking about, and how much worse can it get?
It's a clever title. I like that. And this picture here actually is from a sign in Normandy, France, where I was this summer for vacation. Really, the idea is that, you know, things can get worse. And I think is the world going to blow up? No. But I think that negative interest rates is corrosive and will lead to, I don't want to say really bad things, but not good things. You're removing the signals that we use. I mean, the price of money, interest rates, that's how we signal across economies, locally, globally, demand for various things, and it cues up people to know whether to make more or less of something. When you remove that signal, all of a sudden you're kind of walking in the dark, and it gets very problematic. And the same thing for government policymakers. I mean, how do they go and use the interest rate tool for their determination of where the bottlenecks are in the economy? And so that's kind of what I was alluding to there.
And tell us what the article is about. You've gone into some detail on some trades here, but what is the backstory of what motivates? There's a theme here to these trades. Tell us a little bit about it.
Negative rates aren't totally insane. There are lots of reasons why negative rates are actually reasonable, which I've outlined. But going way out the curve into negative rates, that's more problematic. And what I've done here is said, okay, let's go look at what some of the ramifications are of very long-term negative rates. Recall that a forward price, and this is a big hobby horse of mine, a forward price is not the prediction of where the market's going to be. So if we have a spot rate of X and the forward is Y, it's not that the market, you know, pulled up their hands and voted and said, that's where we're going to be in a year. No, the forward rate is simply the mathematical calculation to create an arbitrage-free price where people can't make money. The forward price is, I won't say simple to figure out, but it's relatively straightforward. You take all the cash flows, the borrowing costs, the lending costs, the dividends, you add them up, discount them back at some PV, and you get a forward price. And what's anomalous here is that when you take these calculations now and add them up, you get forward prices in two of the major stock indices at much lower levels than today's current price. I focus on the European and the Japanese markets. The Japanese one I find to be very interesting. The price of the Nikkei stock index, which is the cheapest of the major indices with a PE of only 15 and change, the 10-year forward price is about 22% lower than today's price in nominal terms. I find that nutty. I don't think the Nikkei is going to be 22% lower 10 years from now, especially if we get more QE in Japan. And that price is not a prediction. It's just the pure mathematics of a dividend yield of 1.5%, 2% and negative 10-year rate going up for 10 years. And this allows you to use the derivative market, either futures, forwards, or options, to create some pretty fancy trades that have what I think are unbelievable profiles. And the same thing occurs in the foreign exchange market.
Okay, explain how these trades work, because you've already said these forwards are not a prediction. It's just a mathematical discounting of an interest rate. So the whole idea is it's supposed to, as you described it yourself, it's supposed to create a number from which there is no risk-free arbitrage. So if there's no risk-free arbitrage, how do you make money from trading this? Explain the theory of your trades.
Well, I'm not borrowing, lending. When I do these trades, it's a one-way trade. These are not arbitrage trades. They're risk trades. I put them on for myself, and I don't hedge them. They are, I think, are incredible portfolio positions. They're going to be volatile. But if you look at the current Nikkei, it's about 22,000. The forward price is like 17,000. And when that and that's the price that people, that dealers, hedge funds, other companies can buy or sell the Nikkei 10 years forward. I mean, it trades. If you go then slap on some options onto this, you can create a profile where you can basically buy like a 10% out-of-the-money call and sell almost a 40% out-of-the-money put out 10 years for no cost. I kind of like the idea. I think the Nikkei is going to rise nominally, either A, because it's relatively cheap, or B, because the Bank of Japan starts buying single-name stocks. They already own 77% of all ETFs and 40-odd percent of the entire bond market. And before you jump up and down saying that I'm bearish on the yen also, I think that you're going to see the Nikkei advance more than the yen depreciates. And so in real terms, you're going to make money. And the reason for that is Nikkei is ownership of real assets, right? Steel companies, car companies, computer companies. Those real assets, they make goods and they sell them, and the prices of them float with the currency to on the global markets. This is exactly what happened in Europe, in Germany, during the Weimar Republic. You may have had you've seen the pictures of the people with wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks. What you don't see is the fact that the stocks of those various companies went up even faster, because they were real companies. And that's what I think is going to happen here. And so if I could own basically a near the money option, 10% out of the money, and my risk is that the DeFi is going to be below 14,000 10 years from now, if you can live with the mark-to-market risk, I love this idea. And basically, I'm taking advantage of the forward and the option skew to lock in this profile.
Harley, you've got some charts which talk about these forwards on pages 4 and 5, but then on page 6, you've got a very interesting chart. Tell us what this one is about with the purple and orange lines, which you're calling the Helio line and the creamsicle line.
So what's happening here is kind of interesting. As noted, we have the forward price of the yen. So today is 107, 108. 7 years forward is like 90. So it's a much lower forward price. And as noted, it's not magic. It's just the differential between the dollar and the yen interest rates and the cross-currency borrowing cost. So that creates a lower forward. What's interesting is when you get a big differential in spot and forward, you should get a higher volatility. Because if you think about it, the spot price is today's price. The forward's a number you could buy or sell. As time goes by, in theory, if the forward goes to 107, 108, or the spot goes to 90, that's kind of what the market's looking at. That's a big move. And so as you widen the spread from spot to forward, what you usually see is implied volatility increases, because the wider the spread means the greater the uncertainty. And the greater uncertainty should mean a higher implied vol, because implied vol is the cost of risk. This is why you see volatilities come down in a flat yield curve, and they go up in a steep yield curve. And you can go onto my website and find a number of times I've written about this. What we had 5 years ago is the purple line, and you can see that short-dated options, one-month options, were at 6% implied vol, and long-dated options were at 14%, reflecting the big differential between the spot and forward prices, which was created by the rate differential. The orange line is what we have right now. It's almost a flat curve. You have a 6% short-dated volatility and 7.5%, 8% long-dated vol. That's just nutty. When you have a differential between the spot and the forward, that's big. Volatility should be a lot higher to reflect that. And it's not. Why isn't it? There's a million reasons, but the biggest one I'd point to is the Bank of Japan's yield curve control process, where they've said, we're going to keep that 10-year between negative 0.2 and positive 0.2. Speculators have kind of given up on the market moving in Japan, and volatility has gone down because there's no buyers, and as a matter of fact, there's more sellers. Are they going to be right? I kind of think not. But what this has done is create a really strange situation where a two-year option on dollar-yen struck at 100 cost 5.75 points. A seven-year option, so 5 years longer, same strike, cost 375, about 35% less, 2 full points less. This is not an arbitrage. You can't buy one and sell the other because they're European options. But it's a way of basically demonstrating how crazy these forwards are, that they create this kind of pricing opportunity where basically you can buy an option with positive carry. The last time I checked, when you're long an option, you have theta, you have negative carry. Here you have positive carry on an option. And that's basically kind of summing up the concept of how negative rates have had the unintended consequence of moving prices around to create interesting investment opportunities.
And for our more sophisticated listeners who are able to put on these complex derivative trades, as you just said, it's not an arbitrage because these are European expiries. You can't just buy one and sell the other. What do you do here? What is the actual trade that you put on to take advantage of if you're expecting that there's some kind of reversion in this anomaly that exists in the market today?
Oh, you just buy the seven-year option. The 7 years is worth the wrong price. The 2 years fine. 7 years the wrong price. You just buy that. Buy it, put it away, don't hedge it. If nothing happens, it just goes up in price over time. And if things really go haywire, you have unlimited gain and limited loss of, 3.75 points over 10 years. Burning 37 basis points a year for 10 years, that's not negative carry, man. That's nothing. I think it was one of the best tickets in the market. I have this one personally, and this trade is available from almost every Wall Street dealer.
It really is amazing. You know, normally we get so used to just certain rules that are ingrained into our minds. Never, ever buy very long-dated options unless you have an incredibly strong conviction about your view, because long-dated options always cost a lot. Well, sometimes the perversion of negative rates makes them cheaper than short-dated options. That really is very unexpected. Is that why this mispricing is there? Because most people aren't even thinking it's a possibility?
There's two things going on here. Number one is you were right, were being the operative word. You used to see a very big upward-sloping term surface. So that means the implied volatility, the cost of a one-month option, was a number, and a longer date option was a higher volatility. So as time went by, if you bought a long date option, you lost on the theta, but more importantly, you lost on the vega as you rolled down the term surface, and that's the purple line right here. What's happened, and this happened in most markets, the term surface has flattened. Long date options have come down. There's a number of reasons for that. Doesn't really matter what they are. The flattening of the term surface has really changed the investment process. And I think why it's there is people have kind of given up. They feel that the Fed and the other central banks have basically colluded together to go and reduce risk. I'm not predicting a disaster, but this is exactly what happened in 03, 04, 05, when the Fed raised rates at a measured pace at 25 cents every meeting. And they said, this is what we're going to go and do. When the Fed signals that they're going to do something in a path, you can have problems there, because people will then go and take advantage of it by taking too much risk.
Okay, Harley, let's spin this another way. I think it's pretty clear that the Fed is going to be forced to continue to hold rates low for as long as they're able to. What other creative ways are there to take advantage of this in terms of trades that benefit from expectations? Obviously, nothing's guaranteed. You could have rates back up to 5% tomorrow, but you and I agree that's profoundly unlikely. What are other ways to exploit that viewpoint?
I'm going to go and preview my next commentary, which could be a while before I write it, but the basic idea is this. I said there are two reasons why these trades exist. One was negative rates and flat ball surfaces. The other is that people don't want to take liquidity risk anymore. Sharpe ratios have become the dominant tool for analyzing investments. And the Sharpe ratios are basically saying, how volatile is the asset I'm buying versus the return? They take that ratio. It was a great idea to go in and start to look at how volatile a trade is, an investment is, versus its return. This is Markowitz, who got a Nobel Prize for it. But to say that the daily mark-to-market volatility of an instrument has some kind of relationship to the probability it will reach its expected return is nonsense. Yet, Sharpe ratios are what everyone's using now to go and sell their various funds and investments. They always say risk-adjusted return. Risk-adjusted return should be, what are the odds I'm going to get my money back, not what are the odds it's going to go up and down by 1% or 2% per day. And you see many investment managers having stop outs where if a price goes down by 6%, I have to sell. I'm not sure why. I mean, my answer to that is just buy less of it. They get stopped out, which is why I say sizing is more important than entry level. And I think what you've seen is this migration of investment managers to short-dated, liquid, transparent instruments, and which is why hedge funds have yielded, 3-4% in the last, 5 years over here? They're all in the same place in highly liquid instruments. And anything that has some bid offer to it, it has some mark-to-market volatility, it's basically, open season out there. No one's trading in that. My advice is, at the trades I described to you are for professionals, but for the average listener, look for investments where there's a liquidity premium for it, where the people are demanding an extra return because it's volatile or because it's hard to get out of. Closed-end funds are a classic example. I love closed-end funds. They yield 8 to 12%. But these funds, they don't trade that much. I mean, they trade enough to get in and out of them. I mean, if you want to go buy 100,000, 200,000, it's pretty easy. But if you had a few million dollars, you couldn't do that, at least not in one day. And they trade at a supreme discount because of that, because you can't get in and out in a day. I think looking for investments where there is a liquidity premium, not a risk premium, not the odds that you're going to lose your money, but a liquidity premium that means you can't get out in one day at a single price, that's where I want to put my money. That's where opportunity lies, because I can go and diversify myself. I can allocate in size appropriately. I can barbell the strategy so I have some money in liquid assets and other monies in longer-term profile instruments. I know what my basic financial needs are going to be, and I have some extra money put aside in case of an emergency, but I can allocate some money for illiquid instruments. That is where the return is. So I have an illiquid portfolio, but it's not going to blow up on me. I will get my money back if I'm patient.
You know, Harley, you're really focusing on one of my favorite topics, which is the disparity that exists in perception in the industry. So many people think volatility and risk are the same thing, and they're just not. And it's the reason that Sharpe ratios are so misleading. You've just explained why that fallacy of volatility equals risk is not true, and you've gone a step farther and described how you can actually benefit and trade it by looking for opportunities that are mispriced, because so many people have an incorrect understanding. They're equating risk with volatility when they shouldn't be. What other fallacies exist in finance that yield tradable opportunities other than the perception of volatility and risk being the same thing?
I think, you know, it's instead of looking outward, it's looking inward. It's saying, what are my financial needs and what are my cash flow requirements over time? And then lining those two up. I think people, they want to go to a cocktail party and they want to brag that they're invested in a hedge fund. When are these instruments really doing better than the market? Are you really getting some advantage? Or you just get the sound of, I'm in an alternate asset class, which a hedge fund truly is not. It's just other asset classes put together with a fee structure. It kind of bleeds off of my usual comment that, you know, it's always greed, ego, and hubris. You know, the Greeks had this right 3,000 years ago. That tends to be the destroyer of mankind. And people make investments based on their ego as opposed to their rational needs. And I think if they focused on that, they'd probably end up in a better place. And it would mean that they don't have to get caught in a bad situation. If you get over-levered or you put your money into too much in one bucket over there, when you get a drawdown like, you know, 2009, you're forced to sell. If you've set yourself up so you've allocated your monies properly and you have a risk bucket and it goes down, but truly it's not going to default on you, you could ride that out. And the people who rode out 2009 are clearly heroes, but I will tell you, it's hard to do. I'll tell you, last December 24th, you know, I was about to jump out the window. It looked pretty bad, but I had allocated the money, I'd allocated the risk, and I said, I could survive this because what I've done is I'll be okay. Even if these prices are staying here or going even lower, I'm okay because I had allocated properly. Sizing is more important than entry level. Don't try and time the market. You're not going to do it. No one's going to do it. Size yourself properly and diversify. It's not sexy, but it works.
Well, Harley, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Before we let you go, for our listeners who want to follow your work, you run this fantastic, you're basically a retired guy just out of the goodness of your heart. You're operating this fantastic website, Convexity Maven. As far as I know, you don't even sell anything. Tell us what the website is about, what people can expect to find there.
Well, you're welcome. ConvexityMaven.com is where I post. Publish every, I don't know, 2-3 months, depends upon what mood I'm in. I would say retired is mostly true. I like to say I run a hedge fund of one, because I'm not sure I can get any other investors to come on in. If you have questions or comments, want to be added to my list, harley@bassman.net. I'd also say that if you're interested in educational materials, I'm always asked about books. I basically kind of culled through my commentaries, and I posted some in the Maven's Classroom. And that's probably a good source to look at interesting ideas, or where I have pieces I've written that explain a concept as opposed to a trade.
Well, Harley, if you're running a hedge fund of just one investor, it seems to me like a perfect opportunity to indulge that ego and hubris and charge yourself a higher fee than any hedge fund has ever charged anyone else before. And that way you can feel that you're earning, I think Medallion Fund was 5.44. So charge yourself 6.45 and you'll be the best paid hedge fund manager in market history.
A clever idea. Maybe I'll try that.
Okay. We'll see you next time, Harley.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
We'll leave it there. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Harley back on the show. I mean, I loved the title of his piece, The Opposite of Bad is Worse. I thought it was really clever. Anyway, what did you take away from his interview?
I really enjoyed the discussion of the trades that he looks at. It's always fascinating to me to see how these guys that really, really understand the market well organize their trades. And it actually inspired me to think, you know, it's a topic. I'd love to get some feedback from listeners if they want this or not. But Harley has become a pretty amazing private investor. You know, he used to be a pro finance guy. He's the only person I've ever met with his own personal ISDA. So he can actually trade over the counter derivatives as an individual investor. I've never heard of anybody else doing that. So I'm thinking at some point we should do an interview with Harley about being a private investor and gaining access to the things that professionals are used to having access to, like over-the-counter derivatives that are not available to most of us. So let us know if you want that interview someday, folks. But in any event, every time I talk to Harley, I've never met the guy personally, but I really like him. He's one of my favorite guests that we have on the show. In any event, Patrick, I also know that our listeners are very, very much in love with your chart books, and people are looking for extended equity market coverage this week. So listeners, you'll find the download link for Patrick's chart book in your research roundup email. The link says post-game chart book. Patrick, let's dive right in. You've got it titled Global Equity. You've got a weekly chart, it looks like, of the S&P on page 2. What's going on here?
Right. So I just wanted to talk the stock market right off the bat. We obviously had a pretty big down day earlier in the week, and had a lot of people asking the big question as to whether or not this, after the quad witching, there was going to be a big swoon on the downside of the stock market and some seasonal heavy selling coming in. What I wanted to really illustrate on this chart is that there has been no technical damage yet done to the S&P weekly chart. I mean, even a 100 S&P point drop down to 2,900 or less would still not even have challenged the prevailing uptrend. And so in my mind, the bears, if they want to take this market lower, have a little bit of work ahead of them to kind of break this trend. At the same time, if the bulls continue to consolidate here and hold the line, then that becomes a very important pivot for a potential breakout to 52-week highs. It's a really interesting place where there's a tug of war going on the markets. And it'll be interesting to see which way it breaks. For me, in order for me to really get bearish, I want to see the market south of 2,900. And even then, the real technical damage is below 2,800, which is about a 6-7% drop in the market, which there's zero sign of coming in just yet.
This is the S&P chart. What if we look at some of the other equity markets, both domestically and internationally, and see how they're faring?
Right. So this is where I want to talk about the Russell 2000 weekly chart. So the small caps had a pretty big reaction. They seem to have correlated when we saw that big momentum value factor blowout that occurred the other week. And the small caps got bid during that whole period. But the thing that I want to highlight is small cap stocks really peaked in September of 2018. And this entire year, we have not seen a meaningful meaningful attempt to break higher on the Russell. The Russell's highs have been coming in throughout the year, more or less around the 1600 level, and we have not really seen a meaningful breakout. So in my mind, the Russell is still the big laggard. Now, will it break out? That's one of the big questions that I think we're watching in the coming weeks. But right now, they're still the dog within that group. What I wanted to move on, though, is to chart four, where I put up the NASDAQ, and I intentionally put the monthly chart because on Twitter and a few places, I've heard a number of prominent technicians talk the monthly charts, and particularly when using RSI divergences to point out that there's a substantial momentum loss. And this is very evident in almost all U.S. equities. I chose the NASDAQ here, but really whether you go S&P, Russell, Dow, it doesn't matter which one you take. What you're seeing is that there is a substantial divergence in that. So for those not familiar with the RSI, it's the Relative Strength Index. It measures the magnitude of the rises, and in this case, on a monthly chart of each monthly advance. And so when the RSI is normalizing or heading down toward the 50 line while the S&P or any of the markets rally, it's telling you that it's doing so with less and less momentum. And a lot of technicians observe that as a sign of a bigger topping formation developing. Go back to those weekly charts I showed earlier on the S&P. We're not seeing a lot of signs of the trend breaking, but at least from a momentum perspective on monthly charts, there really is a divergence that we can't ignore.
Patrick, let's expand this conversation and take it international, starting with emerging markets. What do we see there?
Well, in the emerging market space, I'm using the EEM ETF for this, but I wanted to illustrate on the weekly chart just how pathetic the rally has been in the emerging markets. I mean, while we've had a meaningful rebound in equity markets throughout the January to present period in markets like the S&P and the Euro stock taking it all the way back to their 2018 highs. But what you have with the emerging markets is they're actually still trading very close to the ranges they traded through October and December of last year. And so we have not seen emerging markets bid. They continue to be very weak, sequentially lower highs. If there's going to be a bull phase in emerging markets, we have not seen it yet. This chart just continues to look very, very weak. And it'll be very curious as to whether those lows from 2018 and 19 are going to give out on the next sell cycle.
Well, Patrick, on page 5 here, this emerging market chart definitely seems to coincide with what we've heard from a lot of our guests on the program, which is, look, the U.S. stock market is still pretty strong, but global stock markets are definitely rolling over. But if we move on to page 6, which is Canada's stock market, it's not rolling over there. You're looking at new all-time highs.
Right. And so it's pretty interesting what happened in Canada. Like, you can basically summarize the TSX 60 in Canada to being weighted into three major sectors: Canadian banks, energy, and mining. And that's like 70% of the index. And so when those energy stocks were bid the other week, and there was that meaningful rebound in both US and Canadian financials, it caused the TSX to break out to a 52-week new high. And a lot of technicians look at that pattern and look at that as a fresh new breakout, that it should ensue a new bull advance. And while I certainly don't want to say that it's impossible for it to happen, I remain a little bit skeptical, because really, for a continuation, you need to really see a big breakout in oil and energy and for that trend to really continue. If we don't see that really develop, then I think that fading this breakout is probably the path of least resistance. But moving on, though, I wanted to really touch on Europe. On page 7, I have that Euro stock 50. And what I find fascinating is that really what we see is that natural pattern of a very weak currency, and it actually acts as a tailwind for their equity. And so as we're recording, we have the euro looking to head right down to the 109 level on the downside, a fresh new breakdown. And so the currency weakness is so evident in the euro, but that doesn't seem to be an issue for European stocks, which are very very close to testing the 2018 highs. And it'll be really interesting to see whether or not that this trend continues, where maybe the euro heads down to, you know, 108, 105 with a massive US dollar breakout. And at the same time, maybe that actually acts as a tailwind, pushing the euro stock 50 higher. It'll be really interesting to see.
Let's take it around the world to Japan and look at the Nikkei, Patrick. We're not seeing quite as much strength there as we are in Europe.
Absolutely. And when we look at Japan, what I find interesting is that it really reminds me of looking at the Russell chart, doesn't it? To me, what you saw was those 2018 peaks. In the case of the Japanese Nikkei, it double topped throughout 2018. And the rallies throughout this year have barely retraced half of the losses that occurred during that October to December sell-off. So the chart on the Nikkei surprisingly mirrors that of the Russell. It'll be interesting to see whether or not that pattern continues. But really, that's not where the real strength in equities is. But what it, I really did want to talk about, though, is on page 9, where I have the Sensex. And when we're talking about the India Bombay markets, they just recently, at least the headlines are, is that they implemented huge new corporate tax cuts, a very Trump-style move to do, injecting, I guess, some sort of fiscal stimulus into their system. The Sensex took it very bullishly, and we saw a huge breakout in their market. And the chart has looked incredibly bullish for the last 3-4 years. And it's really interesting to see whether this is a real new breakout. You know, I'll do a shout out to Kevin Muir, who brought this to my attention and had me start looking at this market. But I'm very curious as to whether there's a meaningful new bull leg coming in India.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to find out. Meanwhile, Patrick, you've got a new video out for your subscribers, for paying subscribers, which is using options for trading commodity stock cycles. Now, that is intended only for paid subscribers. Can people get access to that with the complimentary 14-day pass that's available at bigpicturetrading.com?
Exactly. So first of all, it's an update from what we did at Macro Voices Live in Toronto, where I did the original presentation on this. I updated all of the slides that I did during that session, and I put together a new fresh video for it. It's in the members section of our site, but anybody who accesses a 14-day complimentary access, which is available to all Macro Voice listeners, you can watch the video at your leisure.
All righty. Thanks, Patrick. Today's episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to get your free copy of their free book about trend following. Just go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsorinfo. And if you haven't already, be sure to sign up for a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which contains links to all of the best free content we could find on the internet, including download links for our own presentations. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the Harley Bassman Convexity Maven article that they discussed during the main interview. There's also the chart book link we discussed during the post game. There's also an interesting article from Ray Dalio talking about the impact of China's growth on the world economy, and a great macro ops piece titled Liquidity and the Frozen Ice Theory. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we're getting from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownson, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.